And now we've got more economic news with our regular economics contributor, Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She is an economist and the president of Bennett College. Hi, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. So when you
You're
think
doing
about
better than the economy, right?
I guess so. You know, when you think about what Marcus Mabry just said, he said, this is a Wall Street issue, not a Main Street issue. Do you agree with that?
Not at all. I mean, I think he's basically right that it hits Wall Street harder than it hits Main Street, but it does hit Main Street too, especially if you're African and American and had already bumped up against a stringent credit requirements. I think that there are going to be several restructurings, and one thing that needs to happen is we need to talk about people's right to have access to credit and the ways that people are judged as being credit worthy. The tendency now is going to be to tighten up because we had this real estate debacle that's affected everyone from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which puts the stockholders, the taxpayers on Front Street for $200 billion, but we're also looking at, of course, Lehman, and we're looking at Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch is a 158-year-old company that it's possibly, you know, it's failed, it's really gone out of business, it's been taken over, is alarming. But they got themselves into this mess, and what I don't want to see happen, and it will happen to people in Main Street, is that there's the sister or the brother who's been saving their money, trying to get a down payment on a home, and there were some terms and conditions that they start out with, and those terms and conditions are going to change. So that's a Main Street issue.
Let me ask you very specifically, when you think about what has been going on with credit in terms of specifically people buying homes, a lot of people were looking for no money down or 3% down or, you know, all Fannie Freddie money. Are we really looking at a situation where someone who has a solid income but doesn't have, you know, more than a 5% down payment is just out of luck?
Those conditions are going to tighten, and that's the part that I don't think is fair. I don't think that there's anything wrong with a 3, 5, or 10% down. I mean, in the good old days, it was 20% down or nothing. But the fact is that if you can pay rent, you can pay a mortgage. And many cities have had programs for Rye over the years where young people, first-time buyers and others got city assistance to come in with a 3% or 5% program. Now, zero down, I think, is a stretch. I do think that people need to be prepared for what home ownership is about. But we're going to see a series of conversations about how the rules change. The role of Fannie and Freddie is going to be renegotiated. The people who have money are always going to have access to money. And I'm concerned about those people in the middle at the margin. As I said, someone who makes 40, 50 grand a year who's been saving his or her money for the past 3 years just to get into that home. Those are the folks that we need to worry about. Those are good folk who add to neighborhood stability. See, home ownership isn't just about Farai today and he gets to own a home. It's also about Farai moves into a neighborhood in L.A. where the higher the rate of home ownership, the more neighborhood stability we see. You not only contribute to your own economic development, but to that of your neighbors. Renters are just less stable than owners are. Owners are more likely to, you know, paint the fence, mow the lawn, keep the property values up, and so it is seen as an economic development move for people to own their home. So we need to look at the big picture and the externalities that home ownership brings to a market, not just the individual piece or the fact that these bankers, see, this didn't have to happen. These people went too far out on a limb. It's not the person with a 3% down that we need to be worried about. It's the banker who went in to, you know, my line, Pookie, who didn't read the fine print and said, you know, I'll just give you money and you're going to be able to pay $1,000 a month for the first 2 years. And Pookie said, cool, and didn't know that in year three it was going to jump up to $2,500. And how do you go from $1,000 to $2,500? So those are the instruments that I'm working, you know, all those boutique instruments, the balloon payments, all that, those were the messed up mortgage instruments that these people got creative on, and that creativity has now come back to bite them.
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are back with Dr. Julianne Malveaux, economist and president of Bennett College. We're breaking down the latest economic news as we do every Monday. So I'm going to plunge straight into another topic. That's gas prices. They rose more than 6 cents in one day following news of the damage to the Gulf Coast. There's a lot of oil industry there. Tropical Storm Ike also damaged that area. Now, there's a question of whether or not folks are getting unfairly gouged. One gas station is said to have charged $5 for a gallon of regular, and there's some other places in the damaged areas that don't even have gas. So is this price gouging? And I'm not just talking about the people in the affected areas, but people across the country.
There is some price gouging, I think, when you get to $5. On the other hand, when you're talking about what's happening with production, the fact is that there are almost immediate shortages. Gas stations have the gas that they have under their stations to pump. That's all they have. They have to get deliveries of other gas, and if it's more scarce, it costs them more. So if someone decides in anticipation of price rises to raise the price on the gas under their station, that's not fair, but it's somewhat reasonable. But when they take it from a few cents to $5, if it was being posted as $3.65, which was the national average, and then you get up to $5, that does seem to be a bit much. Here in North Carolina, I mean, we're at a high of $4.08 on average. It's a record for our state, and I think in other states you're seeing that. Part of it really is availability. If people are getting their gas from the affected areas and pipelines are shut, that means that there's going to be less gas. I know they ran out of gas in Houston. They ran out of gas in parts of Galveston and Beaumont simply because they weren't getting deliveries. There's a limited amount of gas that stations can hold at any point in time. And so you're really talking, Farai, almost about spot markets.
Now, we've also talked about gasoline in other contexts, but, you know, including family budgeting. But what about heating oil? In some parts of the country, the heating oil season is coming up, and for some folks, we're talking about heating oil assistance, et cetera, et cetera. What's the heating oil situation? What's the forecast for this winter for how prices are going to go?
Well, people are hoping that the pipelines in the Gulf area are going to be very quickly repaired. But if they aren't, we can look at price increases, very much like the gas price increases. They won't go up quite as rapidly because many city and state public utilities commissions will regulate those, but people can expect to see some increases. And, of course, there are lots of programs, and people with limited income should begin to look at them immediately. When you get your heating bill, they should have a flyer in there that talks about what you can do to get heating assistance. You need to jump on that immediately because there's a lag. It's not, it takes a couple of months to get that, you know, in the works. And so if you think you're going to have a problem, work on it sooner rather than later so you don't run the risk of having your, you know, heat turned off.
I certainly remember, and now I'm living in California, so that I don't quite have to do this, all of the different things you can do to save money on energy, everything from making sure your windows are caulked properly, making sure that under the doors you're not getting a lot of leakage from outside. How do people find out more about how to do those kinds of things that can really decrease your energy bill?
Most heating companies, your public utility, whatever you pay, will generally have some flyers in your bill. Most people throw those away. They don't pay attention to them. There's some really valuable tips there, so I would encourage people to take a look at those things and to begin to deal with them. Obviously, insulation is important, so the whole thing of what's going on with your windows and with your insulation is something that people should pay attention to now in the fall as opposed to in the winter when they'll really be hit by this. There are websites, Farai, that people can go into to look at some of this, and I would say to someone, just Google, you know, heat-saving tips, and you get a dozen things coming up. But you don't have to passively consume heat. You can very actively decide to contain the amount of heat that you're consuming so that you basically are not victim to these very high prices that we're likely to see.
Finally, and we're going to talk about this more in the future, what can people do as couples, particularly married couples, where one person is going to have a lot of financial liability with the other person and decision-making is split. Is there any advice for how to deal with situations where one person says we need to spend our money on this, another person says we need to spend money on that, or situations where one person loses a job? Just any quick advice, and we'll go into that more at a later date.
People have to talk about it. I think that with money, I mean, people are more likely to tell people how often they have sex or whatever than to talk about money. But couples really have to be very transparent about money. If you're in a committed relationship, you have to have each other's back. But you can really only do that if you talk about your money and also about your money style. One of the most interesting things that happens with couples, Farai, is that one's a spender and one's a saver. And that causes all kinds of problems. One person wants to squirrel away every extra penny, and then you've got the extravagant one. They've got to talk about it and make compromises. And Michelle Singletary has a new book out, which is great, talking about couples and money management, and there are a lot of other tools. But the first tip is just to have an honest conversation about what your money priorities are, how you spend your money, and what's important to you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Malveaux.
Thank you.
Dr. Julianne Malveaux is an economist and president of Bennett College.